FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana.
Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today, October 4th, 2009, WILL AM 580. We've got a great show for you today. We're going to be talking about media, media politics, media issues, and we're going to go straight to the source, the head of Free Press, the nation's leading media reform organization. We'll be talking with Josh Silver for the full hour. But before we go to Josh Silver, let's go to Media Minutes.
Any views or opinions expressed by the hosts of Media Minutes are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of this station, its management, or licensee.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
With the emergence of technologies like TiVo and online TV that allow viewers to watch programs without commercials, marketers have been aggressively pitching their products in the programs themselves. There were nearly 30,000 product placements in the top 10 broadcast shows in 2008, and there was a 23% increase in the first quarter of this year. But there are no laws regulating embedded advertising. Public advocacy groups are calling for the Federal Communications Commission to develop rules for clear disclosure for all TV marketing and to ban all embedded advertising from children's programming. Nancy Marsden is a former teacher who became so concerned about undisclosed product placement that she left her day job to advocate full-time for better rules for TV marketing.
Consumers have a right to know when they're being advertised to. If knowing the truth that they're watching advertisement is a turnoff, then it's incumbent upon industry to respond to this reality, not to hide the truth.
Product placement used to be about placing a product in an existing script. Think E.T. and Reese's Pieces. But now, marketers are asking for more.
Now, the script is literally being written to sell the product. It's commercial propaganda, and it's a slippery slope. Suppose the product is an agenda of some other sort. Propaganda is the ultimate result when the integrity of media is compromised so that we don't know the sources of paid messages that are being placed in content.
Our minds process regular commercials differently than when products are placed in storylines. When the viewer is lost in a story, critical thinking is reduced. This technique is especially damaging to children, particularly when it comes to selling junk food.
Children have a hard time telling the difference between advertising and content anyway. And storytelling is one of the most potent means of persuasion. There's been a lot of research on this. If you embed an idea in a story, people will accept a known falsehood as true if it's embedded in a story. There's research documenting that. Well, children, of course, will accept virtually anything if it's in a story. I learned that when I was a teacher.
For more information about the harms of embedded advertising, go to truthfulmedia.com.
Local broadcasters may be undermining the news and information you receive on your local TV newscast. In an effort to cut costs, some rival broadcasters are merging their newsroom operations. These news-sharing agreements haven't received much press coverage, but they are quietly cropping up all over the country. Corey Wright is policy counsel for Free Press.
The arrangements are not uniform across all markets. In some, they might be only sharing equipment like video cameras or a helicopter. But in other markets, the stations seem to be combining their newsroom staff and operations, and they're basically generating the same or virtually the same news coverage for all the stations that are involved in it.
There are about 16 news-sharing arrangements in place in different markets. Broadcasters argue they need to consolidate their newsrooms due to declining ad revenue. But in the process, they are reducing the number of competing voices serving the community. For instance, in Honolulu, the local NBC, CBS, and My Network stations recently announced that they are condensing the news resources of the three stations into one consolidated joint operation.
everybody is moving into the same building. They're sharing the same studios. They've laid off a significant number of staff from the newsroom, and essentially they're going to be producing newscasts out of these same studios and airing them on different channels.
The arrangements are reducing the number of competing voices serving the community.
The purpose of those rules is to ensure that no particular entity controls too much of the market in a community. In the markets where the stations are basically consolidating their operations, they seem to be skirting the rules because those stations couldn't legally merge under the FCC's rules.
Wright thinks the FCC needs to take a closer look at these new sharing arrangements.
The basic idea when the licensing system was put in place was that the stations would be licensed at the local level and they would compete, and whoever provided the best programming would win. The difficulty is that under local news sharing, these stations aren't competing anymore. They're cooperating, or worse, they're colluding on what news gets covered and how, and that basically hurts competition and decreases the diversity of local news sources for a community, which is the very purpose of having the broadcast media ownership rules in the first place.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit freepress.net.
The views expressed on this program are those of the host and the participants.
Okie dokie, welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today in WILL AM 580, this October 4th, 2009. Our guest today has been on the show before. He's a friend of mine, and I should say as a point of full disclosure before we go to today's program, I was the co-founder with our guest and John Nichols of the group Free Press and served as president on the board until a year and a half ago, and still remain on the board, although my role, is, as Josh will tell us shortly if need be, is a small fraction of what it was for the first few years of the organization. So our guest today is Josh Silver, co-founder of Free Press, the executive director since its birth in 2003, now the group going strong today, here to talk about what's going on with media politics in Washington and nationwide, where the action is, what the big fights are, and what's coming up on the horizon. Josh Silver, welcome to Media Matters.
Thanks, Bob.
Well, Josh, I think let's start with the assumption that a lot of our listeners are unfamiliar with Free Press, its history and what it's done. And so why don't you give a brief discussion or description of the nature of the group, what it does, how long it's been in existence, where you're based, just sort of the lay of the land for our listeners.
Sure. Well, back in 2001, I sat down with a gentleman named Robert McChesney, and we lamented both the dismal state of media, and particularly journalism, and the book that professor had written a couple years prior that made a very simple premise that media policy shapes the media system that we have today. There's no such thing as a deregulated media, and that those policies are made by a handful of well-heeled corporate lobbyists in Washington, and the public is left out of the debate. And the premise of the founding premise of Free Press, the organization, is that the public needed and needs today a seat at the table when crucial media policies are being made. And if that happens, policies will be made in the public interest, and it will shape a system that has more hard-hitting, accountable journalism locally, nationally, internationally, more quality educational fare, and a media system that better serves democracy. We started with this idea back in 2001, as I mentioned, and by 2003 we had a staff of about six, and the organization has grown steadily to about 40 people today, with offices in Massachusetts and in Washington, with a team of lobbyists, lawyers, communications experts, researchers, grassroots organizers, and we have sort of helped make media and media reform a bona fide issue in America.
Josh, what are some of the other groups that work on media reform nationally, or some of the prominent local ones in addition to Free Press? I mean, is Free Press the one that's grown, or are there a whole bevy of these groups?
There's a lot of groups doing a lot of great work, and Free Press is, I guess you could call, a big fish in a small pond. And Free Press is the only national nonpartisan organization that has a number of staff and is working exclusively on media policy. Now, the important thing that we've seen is that since the early part of this decade, when the focus of media reform efforts were largely around preventing the further consolidation of media ownership with the likes of Rupert Murdoch and Viacom and General Electric buying up big swaths of the television and radio markets, that debate has shifted. What we've seen is that markets are changing rapidly. The internet has eclipsed old technologies as the new delivery mechanism for virtually all media, television, radio, phone service, and all these emerging technologies and portable technologies. And that the debate has really shifted away from consolidation, although that has not gone to bed forever, but towards debates over how are we going to support a robust system of journalism that can actually report on the information people need to see and hear, given the market collapse in the newspaper industry and the laying off of journalists, thousands of them, 20,000 by some estimates in the last 18 months, the adverse effect of commercialism on journalism, and how are we going to make sure that future technologies, fast, affordable, neutral internet, are in every home and business, both rural and urban, rich and poor, so that we can realize the dream brought by the internet, which really could allow any website to act like a TV or radio network and completely break open access and distribution of media content.
For much of Free Press's history, it was doing battle, for all intents and purposes, with the Bush administration, which routinely took the position of the dominant firms operating in the industry on all policy matters. I think I can't recall any exceptions offhand. And there's been a change in administration. How does the Obama administration stack up on the core issues Free Press works on compared to the Bush administration?
Well, you know, if you listen to the speeches really well, if you look at the actions, decent. What we are seeing is, under both Clinton and Bush, so under the previous Democratic and Republican administrations, the public has been shortchanged regularly. Now, there were some things the Clinton administration did that were decent, many that were bad. Pretty much everything Bush did was at the behest of the largest cable and phone companies and were bad. President Obama has had good positions during the campaign on things like preventing further consolidation of media ownership. He's made a very strong point. The president has said over and over that he wants to be proactively supportive of more diverse ownership of media. And he has been very good on the issue of internet and net neutrality, which is this law that says that the cable and phone companies that provide your internet can't block or slow down internet content indiscriminately.
Yeah, and we'll go into that later. That's such an important issue.
Yeah, but so far I'm going to give President Obama a B minus, and we can talk a little later about some of the reasons why he's not getting an A. But there is a very clear tendency by this administration to try to satisfy all players, and in this case, some of the real dominant players continue to be cable and phone companies that control 98% of internet connections nationwide. And they've poured about $12 million Verizon spent in the first 6 months of 2009 alone on lobbying Washington.
Our guest, Josh Silver, the executive director of Free Press, joining us for the full hour today, Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. The phone number here at WILLAM 580 is 333-9455. Our toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. The phone lines are open. A bit of business here. 1 week from today, our guest will be Michael Moore discussing his new movie for much of the hour, or a good part of the hour. 2 weeks from today, we'll have the special two-hour fundraising pledge drive show of Media Matters. And instead of being from noon till 2, it will be from 1 to 3. So it'll start an hour later, our usual time, and extend an hour beyond our normal time. So I want all you listeners out there to be in touch with your accountants and bankers and whoever handles your money so you can clear aside sufficient funds to make a pledge, which we'll greatly appreciate, in 2 weeks. So keep that in mind. Josh Silver, let's go back then to what you were talking about with the Obama administration, specifically the FCC, the Federal Communications Commission. The majority is always of the party in the White House. So now we have the five-member FCC has three Democrats and two Republicans. What is the FCC looking like under the Obama administration? How has it changed from the Bush era?
Well, it's certainly much better. There's a gentleman named Julius Genachowski, one of Obama's top fundraisers and a college pal, who is running it. He has a lot of experience in the high-tech sector. He did announce recently that he is going to move a so-called rulemaking at the FCC that would permanently enshrine net neutrality as the law of the land. He's joined by Michael Copps, a longstanding Democratic FCC commissioner who has been fantastic on most issues and is really a great leader and can be credited with the uprising that happened back in 2003 when millions of people came out against media consolidation. A great guy. And Minion Clyburn, who's the daughter of Representative Clyburn, one of the most powerful members of Congress. Those are the three Democrats. The two Republicans are kind of status quo corporate types who seem to be consistently doing the bidding of the lobbies. I think it's important, though, to back out here for a moment and just to look at the big picture as we look at the intersection of media consolidation, the crisis facing journalism, the importance of Internet that I've discussed a bit, and understand that we're looking at a media system that is in a full radical transformation today, moving from the traditional analog television and radio signals to the printing presses that were essentially newspaper monopolies that are shedding advertising dollars at a quick speed because of the Internet. And there's these fundamental questions as we look at the dominance of right-wing radio on the radio dial and sort of superficial television sound bites at their worst, looking like Lou Dobbs and Glenn Beck, but not much better elsewhere. And this fundamental question of where are we going to have accountable, critical, adversarial voices in the news, whether it be on TV, in radio, or in print? And that question you see has to be answered through policy, because it is policy that is going to be able to create new economic models that are viable for newsmakers to be able to do business and distribute that kind of news that we need. And it's going to be an Internet that, just like government payments for building highways or building electrical infrastructure, that same kind of civic involvement, government involvement in making sure that this happens and that the public has affordable, ubiquitous access, that's the same set of questions that's facing the Internet and communications infrastructure of the 21st century.
Josh Silver, let's talk a little bit right now about the issue of network neutrality, which you've raised already, which I think for people who follow free press and media reform politics closely understands been one of the central and defining issues of the movement for the past probably 3 years or even 4 years. Explain again what that means for listeners who may not be familiar with the term, where it has stood politically over the last few years, what the fight's been about, and where it's going from here.
It's a very simple idea. It's actually interesting that it was while we were we've been celebrating lots of anniversaries. 40 years ago, this year was the very first time that two computers were hooked up, connected, and spoke to each other via a wire. And that was the first time in 1969 that we ever saw anything like the Internet. In the 40 years since, we have seen a system emerge that was built on a government-funded program within the military and within universities that subsidized the research and the subsequent birth of the Internet. And always throughout the evolution of the Internet, there's been an overriding principle, which is that the connections between computers is a neutral one. It's a so-called dumb pipe, where the system, the network that carries the information, be it a website or a song you're listening to online, that the owner of the network that connects the computers cannot indiscriminately block or slow down those web pages or that music that you're listening to. What's happening now is, as I mentioned earlier, 98% of the country has either a monopoly or a duopoly, either a phone company with the DSL or a cable company with their internet service, and there's very little competition. Those companies, in order to preserve their old business models and try to keep their revenue up, they want to be able to slow down or block competitive content on the web, so that if I am Comcast or Time Warner, I can say, wow, people are starting to cancel my cable subscription, and they're starting to watch TV through the internet, through web-based video. I don't like that. That's causing me to lose money, so I'm going to block that video that's going to Bob McChesney's house so that he has to keep paying for cable. It's those kinds of schemes that are in the business models of these incumbent cable and phone companies, and that's what we're trying to stop.
And where does it stand? Have you stopped it, or is it still being fought over?
For the time being, we're in good shape. We saw 2 years ago, Comcast, the cable giant, was indiscriminately blocking content against FCC rules, and Free Press, our organization, called them out. We filed a complaint at the FCC, and they were sanctioned, the first time that that had ever happened to an Internet service provider. Since then, the Internet has sort of limped along with a very weak set of what are called principles at the Federal Communications Commission. The reason why there's all this discussion now is that the FCC is moving to pass an official rulemaking, which is like passing a law in the Congress, and that would actually make it permanent and unassailable in protection of net neutrality.
You know, Josh, I think some of our, Josh Silver, I think some of our listeners probably are don't really understand, or would, there's no reason they would, in fact, how lobbying works in Washington, and sort of what the two sides of the battlefield look like. On an issue like network neutrality, you know, there's Free Press with its, I don't know, three, four, or five people working on it, and there's, what, two or three other people from groups like Consumers Union and the like working with Free Press. And is that a pretty accurate picture of who's the team in Washington that's working on network neutrality?
Yeah, if you have a list of the public interest people who are actively working the Hill and the FCC, you're up around eight or so. But there, it isn't.
And that's covering the full terrain of issues, not just network neutrality.
Yeah, just about.
The reason I want to cut you off is I want to, just before you go back to that, give us how many people are on the Verizon, Comcast, AT&T side of the fence working on the exact same issues, especially internet and network neutrality issues. How big is their army?
The numbers are around, we've been keeping track. For the first 6 months of 2009, Verizon had 124 lobbyists on retainer working for them in one capacity or another. Comcast had about 98 lobbyists. We're literally going up against around 500 lobbyists working for a variety of the incumbent industries. However, there's an important side note to this. On certain issues, certainly not all, not issues like privacy or copyright, there are other industries like Google and Yahoo and Amazon and eBay that are actually invested in a neutral network like we are, but for different reasons. So there is an interesting pairing of interest that can be exploited. In fact, Washington is awash in special interest money, and corrupt campaign contributions rule the day and really make most of the decisions up or down. And what we're seeing is that legislators are beginning to understand the sheer economic power of Silicon Valley and the internet industry, and they're starting to hedge their bets. They're starting to say, well, I could go with Comcast and Verizon here, but I could also look to these emerging giants like Google and do what they'd like to do, and I think that I can be assured of some level of support if I do that. So, you know, this is not just a fairy tale story of public interest groups, Davy versus Goliath. It's also taking a lot of strategic alignments where and when we can to play industry off each other.
And, I mean, if I think about it, with the case of network neutrality, it's obvious to me what a Comcast or AT&T benefits by basically controlling what websites come through quickly and which ones don't come through quickly or don't come through at all. That the tremendous commercial, not to mention political, privileges that gives if they have their hands at the bottleneck. Are there other businesses, though? I mean, as you describe it that way, why would any other business want to let those businesses have that sort of monopoly power? I mean, is there any other businesses that are supporting AT&T and Comcast as they try to get rid of network neutrality or eliminate it?
No, good question. Really, the only companies that can be found supporting them are a handful of equipment makers that actually build the physical hardware that can create a non-neutral network that prioritizes some content over the other. But I think it's important to note, as we said at the beginning of the show, policy dictates all of this. And it was actually a quiet ruling by the Federal Communications Commission back in 2005 that nobody paid attention to and virtually nobody reported on that actually created this mess. And what they did was in a single stroke eliminated virtually all competition from the internet service provider market. You may recall in the 90s, you could have several choices for dial-up internet. There'd be a lot of choices, and it was under 10 bucks a month. It was cheap because there was competition. In 2005, making a long story short, the FCC essentially said there is going to be no more internet service provider competition on phone lines, and therefore we can continue to have no competition on cable lines, and they eliminated through policy the competition that would fix this whole mess. Because if we had real competition, we wouldn't have to heavily regulate it, because competition would actually incite different internet service providers to do the right thing and offer cheap quality service.
Yeah, and obviously no one's going to sign up for a censored internet if they can get one for the same price or cheaper that will let them access anything they want.
Exactly.
Our guest, Josh Silver, Executive Director of Free Press, joining us on the phone today from his home, his palatial home in western Massachusetts. The phone lines are open here at WILL AM 580. The number, of course, 333-9455. The toll-free number, 1-800-222-9455. We're talking about the full train of media politics in the United States today. So feel call in with any question or comment you might have. Josh Silver, one of the areas that's risen in prominence, certainly in media activist circles, and maybe slightly trickling into the broader political consciousness, is this notion of media justice, which seems to have some sort of relationship with media reform. What is meant by media justice, and how is it different from media reform? I mean, how do these two ideas work together?
Well, media justice is very similar to parallels in other issues, major issues that we've seen over the past few decades, social justice, environmental justice, and economic justice. And it's a focus on how do we make sure that those underserved communities whose voices are not represented on the media are. And so we look at some staggering facts that have no doubt been cited on your show. Less than 4% of television stations are owned by people of color in this country. Less than 8% of radio stations are owned by people of color, a gross misrepresentation of the diversity that is the United States of America. And so the media justice community is working primarily at the grassroots in tandem with groups like ours to bring these issues to the fore and increase the diversity of viewpoints and representation in the media.
And are there prominent media justice groups out there that are working on issues, or is it more just an organizing principle?
It's an organizing principle with some excellent groups that are working out across the country regionally, but there's no national powerhouse. They don't need that, because groups like ours do work hand in glove with them.
You know, people who follow Free Press's work and go to the website at freepress.net have known that the group has always been strictly nonpartisan and has been very careful in making that clear at all times. And it was sort of a surprise, I think, to some to see in the last couple of months how aggressive Free Press has been on addressing the sort of Glenn Beck issue. And that struck some as being more partisan than Free Press has traditionally been. Explain the Free Press relationship, the nonpartisanship, why that exists, and how the Glenn Beck stuff fits into it.
Well, Free Press is a nonpartisan organization that does not advocate the election or defeat of specific politicians, and we don't promote a specific ideology. And that's crucial. We work with Republicans on many issues where we see eye to eye with them on certain infrastructure issues and certain media issues. There are actually champions of public broadcasting, of journalism, and of ubiquitous internet on the Republican side of the aisle, albeit not too many, but there are there in Washington and in state houses. What happened a few weeks ago was that Glenn Beck, as many of your listeners know, engaged in what we consider a witch hunt, where he went after Obama administration officials based on things they had said in the past, petitions they had signed, and their targets ended up being close friends of ours. One of them was Van Jones, an environmental advisor to the president who used to be on the board of Free Press. And Beck went after him for having mistakenly signed a so-called 9/11 truther petition back in, I think, 5 years ago. And then subsequently Beck went after a gentleman named Mark Lloyd, the chief diversity officer at the FCC, who was tasked with diversifying media ownership. Lloyd, also an old friend of ours, we felt that where Glenn Beck crossed the line, and the reason why we criticized him vocally, was that he was engaged in McCarthy-esque witch hunts, where he was going after Obama administration officials based on their ideology, based on things they had said in the past, but not based on substance, not based on them having broken a law, for example. And it was ringing too closely of McCarthyism, and we knew through direct experience that the victims of Beck's attacks were and are excellent people, great public servants who needed to be defended.
Now, Free Press has how many people that are members or who receive its email missives? How large is the army that you command?
We have about 500,000 members nationwide who have joined us for different reasons, from their concerns about journalism to media consolidation to internet access and the fight around net neutrality. But you know, as we move forward, the direction Free Press is going is a focus on three fundamental areas. One is journalism, and now that newspapers are beginning to close their doors and fire journalists en masse, now that we're seeing that television journalism has become an oxymoron, as has commercial radio journalism, looking at different ways that we can subsidize and support journalism through different kinds of nonprofit and alternative models, and really trying to figure out a proactive solution, as did our forefathers, whom you, Bob, know more about than anyone in the country, about what they did to actively support journalism. That's number one. Number two is public media, or formerly known as public broadcasting, and understanding that there simply is not enough private money in the form of advertising, subscription revenue, and philanthropic dollars to pay for the kind of international, national, and local journalism that communities need in the United States, and looking at how do we get out of last place in industrialized countries in our public media system so that we stop paying $1.35 per person and start paying something closer to the $80 that you see in England or the $100 you see in Finland to really support the kind of journalism our country needs. And the last one is internet, which we've already talked about a bit.
Our guest again, Josh Silver, the phone number here, 333-9455, toll-free 1-800-222-9455. Let's go to our toll-free line right now, line 4, Stockbridge, Georgia. Thank you for your patience. You're on the air with Josh Silver.
Hi, Josh. This is Mel Lyles in Stockbridge. We're a suburb of Atlanta here, as is most of the state now. I wanted to, not switch tracks maybe, but from what I've heard so far on the program, it seems to me like this whole problem is kind of goes back to the larger issue of campaign finance reform, where we are lagging so far behind other Western industrialized countries now. In so many areas because of that same issue that we're being held captive to Washington lobbyists that you were talking about previously. And I was just kind of wondering what ideas you may have as far as using media, particularly internet, where people can connect two-way with each other and develop some kind of a way to get this campaign finance thing in sort of back on the front burner and keep it in front of people where I think it's really a nonpartisan issue, and I'd be interested to see if you know what your ideas may be on that. Because if there are any, I'd certainly like to get involved in it as a sort of podcaster myself.
Well, Josh, before you answer that, I should say that this is a fortuitous question because your background for coming to Free Press was working precisely on this issue. So, on that note, please take it away.
Yeah, thanks for that question. That was a T-ball for me. Yeah, the fact is that you know the most glaring intersection between media and money in politics is actually the amount of money candidates spend on television ads. It's obscene. It represents more than half of campaign budgets. And as you said, the caller said, Europe is way ahead of us. And one of the ways of many that they're way ahead of the United States is that they do provide major party candidates who have proven viability free airtime in the time leading up to the election to run campaign ads, and there are rules of the road for those ads. They can't be attack ads. They can't be superficial. They can't be untrue. They actually have to be substantive and talk about what the candidate stands for and who the candidate really is. That would be step one in terms of a media policy, free airtime, in exchange for the big media companies' use of the public airwaves for free. That needs to be done. But there's another side to this, and that is that I would offer the idea that really at the end of the day, there are two fundamental issues in our democracy that have to change, that have to reform in order for our democracy to become viable again, for our country to actually function. And that is one, media, of course, which we're talking about. But the other is a comprehensive slate of reforms on campaign finance. And those reforms include getting private money out of elections because there is no other solution due to previous Supreme Court rulings. That would be full public funding. Number two would be universal access so that every single American is automatically registered to vote. And I would even support compelling them to vote the way they do in Australia, where you actually get a fine if you don't vote. Number three is ensuring ballot integrity, ending this debate over electronic ballots versus paper ballots. We need to have a verifiable paper ballot system where people know that their vote is being counted. Number four is changing gerrymandering so that the members of Congress cannot artificially chop up districts and shape them so that they can get reelected, but rather to do it in a non-discriminate, fair way. And then the fifth is to change the voting systems themselves, to abolish the get rid of the Electoral College, which was created in the 18th century and no longer works, looking at things like instant runoff voting so that we can not have a winner-take-all system, and there's a few others. So I think we need to look at it comprehensively, and if we do that and reform both tracks, elections and media, then we'll have a democracy.
What would happen, Josh Silver, if we just made it a condition of a broadcast license that a broadcaster couldn't run candidate ads anymore? Or if they ran a candidate ad for a particular candidate, they had to give the same amount of airtime for free for every other candidate on the ballot for that job.
A great idea, and as you know, Bob, the National Association of Broadcasters is just so terrifically powerful in Washington that it has been impossible to move such a change. And, you know, there's two sides to it. One is the obvious money that they have, which is enormous, and the influence that comes with it. But even greater is the National Association of Broadcasters, or otherwise known as the NAB, is famous for bringing the station managers of their TV and radio stations into Washington, onto Capitol Hill, and sitting down with their senators and their members of Congress and making it very clear what it is that they want. And what you find is politicians know where their bread is buttered. They know that if these stations turn against them, are critical of them, and paint them in an unfair way or unfavorable way, they're going to lose their seat. And that has become the most powerful lobby in Washington.
Josh Silver, if folks want to learn more about Free Press or become a member, they, I assume, go to the freepress.net website. How much does it cost to join Free Press?
Well, there's two ways. If you don't have money, you can do it for free. And you just sign up on the homepage, you put in your email, and you put in your zip code, and we will keep you apprised of the issues and tell you when you can get involved. We send out also a free newswire. If you're really into these issues, there's a free sign up on our news page, and you will get a daily, every weekday, a summary of the major news stories that have to do with media and media reform delivered into your inbox. Then, if you've got means and you can contribute, which we do desperately need in this down economy, you can also contribute, and you just go to the donate button at freepress.net.
Josh Silver, our guest today, the executive director of Free Press. The phone number here at Media Matters, 333-9455, toll-free, 1-800-222-9455. Josh Silver, you mentioned that support for public media is now one of the three big campaigns that Free Press is working on, and has been an issue Free Press has worked on for the past several years. You know, with the rise of the Internet, once we get network neutrality so it can't be censored by the AT&Ts and Comcast of the world, and everyone can do their own thing online as long as it's legal, the argument goes we don't need public broadcasting anymore. Why should we be subsidizing what in effect will eventually be just one more website when anyone can go online and do their own thing?
Well, the problem is that journalism requires professional journalists, and professional journalists require a salary. And what we're seeing is it's very clear that opinion makers and bloggers do not replace actual journalists. And so while the Internet is great, what it is doing at the same time that it is it's revolutionizing media is that it's also pulling ad revenue away from traditional media, and that ad revenue used to pay for journalists' salaries. So what we have seen is, as I mentioned earlier in the show, it has become a very simple economic question, and that is there enough money in the private sector to support the kind of accountable, critical journalism that democracy requires? And sadly, the answer is no. And the fact is that the only way that we will have a sufficiently robust journalistic system and media system, educational, culture, arts, is to subsidize it through government coffers. But that does not mean government control of media, and it does not mean government control of content. What it means is a government subsidy for media of all forms, not just PBS and NPR, but community radio, community television, community newspapers, with a very strong ironclad firewall that protects that system from undue political influence. That's not a pie-in-the-sky notion. I mean, although there are warts and problems in other countries, for the most part, other developed countries, particularly in Europe and elsewhere, have public media systems that have sufficient political insulation.
Yeah, Josh Silver, very quickly, earlier in the program, you sort of went through the difference in spending on public broadcasting between the United States and some European nations. Slow down and give a couple of those figures again, because I think they're quite numbing.
Yeah, it's staggering. I mean, in this country, we have approximately $440 million a year goes into the entirety of the public media system,
including community stations as well,
including everybody, going from the U.S. government, federal dollars, and that works out to about $1.35 per person per taxpayer. In England, that number hovers around $80 per person. In Denmark and in Finland, it's over $100 per person. So when we look at efforts to reinvigorate public media in this country, we're really talking about a moderate increase. We're talking about if we could get $10 per person, that would be an increase of what, do the math, about sixfold, and it would have a tremendous transformative change on the system. Now, I would say there are five major components to reforming public media. Those are the one you mentioned, increasing funding. The second is changing the way that the Corporation for Public Broadcasting's board is appointed in order to have more ombudsmen and create that political firewall that we just discussed. A third is to expand the definition of media, public media, so that it explicitly includes community stations and community radio, television, and the other non-traditional public media outlets. A fourth really important approach to public media is to making sure that there is a bold and effective move into the digital space, because they are lagging, not just PBS and NPR, but community media in general, and they have to get ahead of technologies. And the fifth, I will tell you as soon as I remember it.
I was going to say, I was wondering if you had notes. You need a raise if you can remember these five things in the spur of the moment. Well, I'll tell you what, while you're working on the fifth, Josh Silver, let's go to the phone lines. We have three callers waiting patiently, and I want to make sure we give them all the time they deserve. Let's go first to line one, Champagne. You're on the air with Josh Silver, Free Press.
Hi. I'm switching it back to the candidates and running for office and so forth, and I think we should take a leaf out of the book of the British or other Europeans, where they allow only a certain amount of time for campaigning before the election. In England, I think it's like 6 weeks. They allow the people running for office to go around and ask for votes, and then it's over. You know, we wouldn't have 18 months of people having to raise these huge sums of money in order to blast the media and everybody else with their message.
Well, it's a great idea. There's two problems. Number one, the brilliance of the parliamentary system, like you see in Europe, much of Europe, is that they have a non-set schedule for elections. So schedules get elections get called for major office, and therefore you don't have the lead time that you do here when you know a date specific that there's going to be a major election in the United States. The second problem is, back in 1976, there was an important Supreme Court ruling that said money equals speech. It's the reason why that the government does not let us limit the spending of political candidates. It's a huge flaw. It's the reason why public funding of elections is the only solution, is because there's no way to limit the spending to prevent, say, a billionaire from essentially buying an election. But that same law also would prevent the government from limiting the duration of a political campaign in the United States, because that would be effectively limiting an individual's right to free speech as the U.S. Constitution is interpreted. So it would take a constitutional amendment, which would be practically impossible in the U.S. Congress, in order to change that.
Let's go now to line two. Our guest, Josh Silver, the executive director of Free Press, joining us on the phone from Massachusetts. Line two, Urbana, you're on the air with him.
Thank you. I actually wondered how the lobbyists are paid. I know they're paid by big business, but do big business get to count that as expense for their tax return, so that they not only lower their taxes, but they influence our economy unfairly? How come the ACLU doesn't get to count their donations as tax deductible? I've been reading a book, Perfectly Legal, by David Kay, that's C-A-Y, Johnston, J-O-H-N-S-T-O-N, and he talks about all the ways that we as taxpayers are made known.
Yeah, no, it's a great point. I don't know the tax code. My assumption is that the companies do have to pay taxes, pre-tax on funds that they use to lobby. But I think the larger point that the caller gets to is the extent to which corporate welfare has gotten completely out of control. I don't have those numbers in front of me, but what is staggering is to see that the tax breaks that are given to the wealthiest companies, to companies like Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan and the others that have gotten billions in handouts to boot, these tax breaks eclipse the funding to, say, for example, public broadcasting by thousands of times over. They eclipse the money that goes to education in this country, to health care. And so what's so frustrating is that because of the myopic behavior of media and their obsession with profits, their obsession with making substantive news stories into entertainment, what it has allowed to happen is that the likes of Glenn Beck and Lou Dobbs and others, and really not just Fox News, but CNN and networks combined, they really have dumbed down the debate in this country such that you have people, for example, going to a town hall meeting on health care, at which politicians are trying to talk about how to get affordable health care to Americans. And these people are showing up at these events with guns on their hips, and they're talking about how these politicians are trying to take their government away from them, their country away, when in fact these politicians are talking about spending sums of money that are far lower than the amounts that are given out as corporate welfare and corporate tax breaks every year.
Our guest, Josh Silver, you're listening to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. We're talking about media reform politics in the United States today, the group Free Press, of which Josh Silver is the executive director. We've got a little over 10 minutes left, time for another caller at 333-9455 or 1-800-222-9455. Let's go back to the phone lines again. Line 3, Urbana, you're on the air with Josh Silver.
Hello, sir. My name is Cornell. I'm a PhD from this university in Urbana. I come from Romania. I'm a U.S. citizen since 2005. I voted. I am very excited about your topic because in the past 10 years I work on something very related. The thing is... I come from physics, and I noticed that in any domain there are frozen concepts which are not moved for many tens of years or hundreds of years. So in the context of physics, one such a thing is the structure of light. In politics, is this divergence between Republicans and Democrats, in between basically between the conservative spirit and the liberal spirit. So I would claim that this divergence is so fundamental, so powerful, that any reform for the media, for election will be destroyed very quickly if something is not done to try to find a mechanism to reduce or to put this divergence, this fight between the two spirits, conservative and liberal, into something productive. So,
I can speak to that.
Thank you very much, caller. Go ahead, Josh. Yeah,
well, I mean, I think we're getting at two points here that the caller made. One is, you know, people wring their hands and say, I can't believe the Democrats have been so bad on this or that, be it health care or immigration reform, where they make a promise during the campaign and they don't deliver. The fact is that most Republicans are bought and sold by special interests, and by over 90%, and somewhere around 50 to 70% of Democrats. And the fact is both parties are bought, the Republicans a bit worse than Democrats. Conservatives and liberals, those terms have been turned on their heads, because those who are called liberals in the Congress, they don't stand and fight when the time really is there, and people, these kinds of interests need to be protected. So the bottom line is, money has destroyed democratic discourse in Washington, and it has affected both parties, and the media has sort of co-opted conservative and liberal such that they are meaningless terms. And the system needs an overhaul in order for anything to work.
Josh Silver, I don't know if you listened before we went on air today. We run Media Matters, which is produced by Free Press, every week from 101 to 106, a five-minute program with news on media politics. And this week's program of Media Minutes had a story on embedded advertising. And I'm just wondering if Free Press is taking much of a look at or has an interest in, commercialism, hyper-commercialism, the lack of privacy online by the commercial interests learn more about people and use it to sell them stuff they may or may not want. Does that factor into the media reform picture in the future?
It does. It does. These are areas where we struggle because, frankly, the embedding is an increasingly important issue because it's becoming more and more prevalent due to things like TiVo and DVR systems, that recorders that allow people watching television to fast forward through ads. So instead, the ads are placed within the content. It is becoming more and more of an issue. It has not become enough of an issue such that we're paying much attention to it because, frankly, we're too busy elsewhere. Issues like copyright and privacy online, those are also absolutely critical. We keep an eye on them. If something horrible happens, we weigh in. But in general, there are other groups like publicknowledge.org, which deals with issues like copyright and privacy. Also, the Electronic Frontier Foundation also deals with privacy online. But they are indeed the other side of the same coin.
If we're going to have policies, Josh Silver, to resurrect journalism in the United States, to make it viable politically in Washington, what sort of things have to happen so this becomes something that gets taken seriously?
Well, there's a few things. I mean, first of all, there needs to be support that's much louder at the grassroots, and that's very hard. It's been historically very difficult with election reform, campaign finance, as it has been with media, and that's because the biggest grassroots movements tend to be amongst issues that have the most direct impact, things like civil rights, things like the environment, things like health care, where it's a very direct and personal experience that's visceral. These so-called gateway issues, like media and election reform, are much more difficult because they're more cerebral, they're more intellectual. But what we, despite that, we have to get enough people, enough many millions of people who understand the damage, as Jon Stewart from Comedy Central said, the extent to which things like CNN and Fox and the networks are hurting America with their soundbite superficial coverage. And people have to stand up and unite together, understanding that the future of our country is not going to be viable unless we can fix the media. Fortunately, millions have begun to understand that, and that's going to be crucial. I think another thing that has to happen is that our leaders, the politicians in Washington, have to get behind these basic approaches that we've been talking about changing tax policy around journalism, to making a more robust public media system, towards making sure that we have fast, affordable, neutral internet in every home and business in America. They have to get behind that, and they can get behind it, but it's going to take a push from the bottom at the same time that we're pushing from above. And so people need to talk about it. They need to go to freepress.net. They need to sign up. They need to tell their neighbors and get involved.
Now, are the days of worrying about whether Rupert Murdoch or General Electric own all the radio and TV stations over, since those companies aren't doing that well anymore?
I wish. I mean, it is better, in part because the economics of the media market have actually caused some major conglomerates to sell off properties. We also have a Democratic administration that has, for the most part, come out forcefully opposed to further consolidation of media ownership. But we have seen some alarming trends. We've seen these major banks that we just bailed out, like Goldman Sachs and J.P. Morgan. They are starting to go into communities and buy up newspapers, television, and radio stations, and they are going to probably look to regulatory relief to allow consolidation that is not currently permitted. This is a development that's only come up in the last couple of months, and it's cause for some concern because these companies, as we saw in the federal bailout, exert tremendous influence in Washington and would likely have their way unless we can organize a major...
Wait, let's talk about that a little bit more. This is quite striking. So the Goldman Sachs, these big investment banks are now buying up discounted radio and TV stations?
Correct, with your money. And they're also buying systems that are so-called cross-owned, where you might have these companies are buying newspapers and radio stations, which is currently prohibited, and for which these acquisitions, they would need to get so-called waivers that would allow them to break the law and buy these properties.
These guys do such a great job with the banking system. Yeah, we can imagine what they could do to the news media.
Well, it's an untold story. It's these hedge funds that go into communities and buy up media companies and do what they do with any type of property, media or otherwise. And that is, they gut the budgets. They lay off people. They make the company as profitable as possible in the short term in order to turn the company around, sell it, and make a bunch of money.
Well, what about the public interest principles that the people who get these monopoly licenses are supposed to, serve the public?
Those are gone. I mean, those used to exist to some degree, but what we saw is over the last 30 years, the broadcasters have lobbied the FCC.
Josh Silver, I hear the band tuning up in the background. We could go on for hours, as you know, we usually do. Thank you so much for joining us today in Media Matters.
Thanks, Bob. Good to have you.
Our guest, Josh Silver, head of Free Press at freepress.net. I'm Bob McChesney. You've been listening to Media Matters. I want to thank Melissa Trentz for her great job as a producer, Kyle Kroha for working the board. I'll be back in 1 week with Michael Moore. Have a great week, everyone. Bye-bye.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance, private instruction for social or competitive dancing, weddings, or other special events, lessons for singles or couples, beginners or advanced of all ages. Information at 378-4601 or on your web, search at Mike Weaver Ballroom Dance.
In the weather forecast for Champaign-Urbana, mostly cloudy today with a high of 64 degrees. Tonight, mostly cloudy with a low of 44. Monday, mostly sunny skies with a high of 70. Monday night, increasing clouds with a chance of showers arriving after midnight, the low 52. And Tuesday, showers are likely with a high of 68. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3 Urbana.